Stearns touched on several topics, but Martinez was the most pressing one. Signing with the Mets late in spring left him to train on his own throughout February and March, and an expedited progression has resulted in body soreness and lower back tightness. All parties expect the former to some extent, but not the latter, which required him to have a cortisone injection last week. He's clear to start swinging a bat again Tuesday after nearly a week off. I don't know that he needs to show anything. I think he just needs to get into a spot where he says, I'm good to go, I feel good, Stern said. I don't know that there is anything from an evaluation standpoint. I don't know that we're necessarily looking for anything. Here are some other takeaways from Stern's 16 games through the season. First, the DH group. The Mets could have carried Mark Vientos, another left-handed hitter, until Martinez completed his progression, but opted to use a rotating cast of hitters at the DH spot instead. Vientos, Stern said before the Mets broke camp, needed to play every day in AAA and work on his defense and third base. He stands by this decision, giving Beatty a vote of confidence at third. The Mets cut right-hander Julio Teheran after one poor start against the Atlanta Braves. Right-hander Jose Abuto will get some run in that rotation spot after throwing six shutout innings against the Kansas City Royals, the team with the best run differential in the league, plus 39. I think the way Abuto has come up and given us very competitive outings and thrown the ball to a very high level gives us confidence that we're in a good place right now, Stearns said. And over now to the Red Sox. Injuries are a part of baseball, and every big league club will inevitably deal with some. The New York Yankees are currently without Gerrit Cole. The Braves just lost Spencer Strider for the year. And the Texas Rangers have two former Cy Young winners sidelined for at least the next few months. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a club that's been decimated by injury to the degree the Red Sox have. The Red Sox were going to be a young team to begin with, but over the past 2 months, almost every veteran player in the organization has endured one injury or another. Overall, the club has 10 players on the big league roster around the injured list who have at least 5 years of MLB service time, and all but one has been sidelined for some length of time since camp opened in February. Kenley Jansen, the club's elder statesman, fought through a litany of ailments during spring training and is still trying to settle into a rhythm. Liam Hendricks is working his way back from Tommy John surgery. Trevor Story with a fractured shoulder and Lucas Giolito with elbow surgery are both out for the season. Rafael Devers and Chris Martin have each battled shoulder ailments, and Martin also dealt with groin tightness in camp. Nick Pivetta with the right elbow flexor strain and Rob Refsnyder with a broken toe are currently on the IL, and Tyler O'Neill needed 8 stitches above his eye after being involved in a scary collision with Devers on Monday. Boston's only veteran who has so far made it through mid-April unscathed is right-hander Chase Anderson, who didn't join the organization until just before opening day and who has primarily pitched in blowouts. It's not fun, but it is what it is, Red Sox manager Alex Cora said. You've got to be ready for today. The guys that are playing today have got to do their job. That's the attitude we have. That's the attitude they should have. The injured veterans collectively include most of the team's best players, and that group doesn't even include others who have been sidelined, like presumed starting second baseman and Vaughn Grissom, rookie reliever Isaiah Campbell, and promising left-hander Chris Murphy. Collectively, the rash of injuries have put even more pressure on the club's up-and-comers to shoulder the load, a responsibility that ideally would be theirs to bear. Tristan Casas, Jaron Duran, and Masataka Yoshida, three of the guys being counted on to anchor the top of the Red Sox lineup, all have fewer than 2 years of service time. The same is true for Connor Wong, Emmanuel Valdez, and rookies Cedeño Rafaela and Willier Abreu, each of whom is getting regular playing time. The problem became particularly pronounced with Devers sidelined after the weekend or with O'Neill out now. On Tuesday, the Red Sox fielded a lineup that collectively boasted just 10 years of service time with Devers 6, the only starter who even had at least 2. To put that into perspective, the New York Yankees lineup on Tuesday boasted 52 collective years of service time, an average of 5.7 years per player. Their learning core set of the Red Sox youngsters, it's not easy to come in late in games and pinch hit. It's not easy to come in late in games and play defense, but we're here, we're in the big leagues, so we try to help them out to prepare as much as possible, and hopefully it works out for us. The situation isn't much different on the pitching side, with Giolito out for the season and Pivetta currently on the shelf. The starting rotation's elder statesman is Garrett Whitlock, with 3 years of service time, and Tanner Houck, Brian Bayo, and Cutter Crawford all have 2 years of fewer. The bullpen is collectively much more experienced, but the Red Sox are still relying on numerous younger arms, including Josh Winkowski, Brennan Bernardino, Greg Weiser, and rookie Justin Slayton. And I'm going to go to what's on the air today in baseball. At 7 p.m., the Guardians are back up in Boston, and they are playing on NESN and also Radio 1080. That's 7 p.m. Now, in basketball, the NBA, 7 p.m. Eastern Conference play-in tournament, Miami at Philadelphia. That's on ESPN. 7 p.m. Another 7 p.m. game, Eastern Conference play-in tournament, Miami at Philadelphia, on the NBA network. So they repeat that. It's also on ESPN 2. 9:30 p.m. Eastern Conference play-in tournament, Atlanta at Chicago. That is on ESPN. In the NHL, 7 p.m. Toronto at Tampa Bay. That's on TNT. And 9:30 p.m. St. Louis at Dallas. That is on TNT. And before we sign off, just a couple of baseball notes. Carl Erskine, who pitched two no-hitters for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and was a 20-game winner in 1953 when he struck out a then-record 14 in the World Series, has died. He was 97. Among the last survivors from the celebrated Brooklyn teams of the 1950s, Erskine spent his entire career with the Dodgers. He helped them win five NL pennants. Erskine won Game 3 of the 1953 World Series against the Yankees. He appeared in five World Series with the Dodgers, finally beating the Yankees in 1955, for their only championship in Brooklyn. And that's it for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Bill Murphy. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Thanks for spending this part of your day with Chris, Connecticut's Talking Newsstand.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 17th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I will be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we will take a look at the main pictures on each paper front page. On the main page, first page of the New York Times, there are pictures of bridges in America. I'm going to read the caption, then tell you which bridges are pictured here. The caption says, "The collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore has prompted a reassessment on critical bridges around the country that may be similarly vulnerable to a ship strike." We're going to have a story. That'll be my first story. And the bridges that are listed, and it's just a picture of the bridges, Ben Franklin Bridge in Pennsylvania, also New Jersey, connects the two. The Memphis, Arkansas Bridge. The Mid-Hudson Bridge, that's in New York. The Lewis and Clark Bridge, that's connects Washington and Oregon. The Newburgh Beacon Bridge, that's in New York. Robert C. Byrd Bridge, that's West Virginia and Ohio. And the Sherman Minton Bridge, that connects Kentucky and Indiana. And there is one other picture on the front page of the Times, and the caption says, a member of Ukraine's 17th Tank Brigade near the front line in the Donbas region in January. And there's a picture of a soldier, and he's in a tank. And it's, as I said here, he's in line in the Donbas region in January. That's the only other picture on the front page of the Times. Over to the Current, and we will have a story on this. It's made the news. You may have heard this on the TV or the radio, but the Canadian geese in Bristol, there seems to be a problem, and right, which I'll read about, but the picture is just a picture of the geese walking around the pond and walkways at Veterans Memorial Park in Bristol. And that picture was taken on Tuesday. Then one other picture on the front page of the Current, picture of former President Donald Trump awaiting the start of proceedings Tuesday in the New York courtroom on his hush money trial. That's going to be, I believe it's taking a day off today, and they'll be resumed tomorrow. I think they picked seven jurors already. We'll have that article for you. So I'm going to go into the article from the Times about the bridges. The Lewis and Clark Bridge has towered above the Columbia River for nearly a century, its rugged half-mile truss serving as a gateway for logging trucks and beach vacationers crossing between Oregon and Washington. Decades ago, to protect against wayward vessels that could threaten the structure, crews installed timber shields around the bridge piers that rise up out of the water. But even as the cargo ships chugging up the Pacific Northwest's largest river began to grow in size, the timbers rotted away, leaving the bridge vulnerable to disaster. If a ship hits one of those piers, it's gone, said Jerry Rieger, a semi-retired contractor who lives near the bridge and has spent years pressing transportation officials to install new protections. The state views the risk of calamity as low and the cost of preventing it to be high. Bridges across the country carry similar deficiencies. At 309 major bridges on navigable waters in the United States, inspections in recent years have found protection systems around bridge foundations that were deteriorating, potentially outdated or non-existent, leaving the structures perilously exposed to ship strikes. A New York Times analyst of federal data and shipping traffic found dozens of these vulnerable bridges spanning waterways that serve as corridors for large vessels around places like Boston, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. The review identified 193 bridges that each carry 10,000 vehicles or more a day that have no protections installed around the piers planted in the river and seabeds that hold up the bridges. The potential risk became starkly apparent last month when a cargo vessel appeared to lose power and struck a pier at the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing much of the 1.6-mile structure to collapse into the water and killing six people. But the Times showed that bridges across the country have suffered similar catastrophic failures in recent decades in places like St. Petersburg, Florida, Mobile, Alabama, South Padre Island, Texas, and Weber's Falls, Oklahoma. Those costly and sometimes deadly disasters have brought calls to enhance bridge protections. The Biden administration in 2021 pushed through legislation that will provide $40 billion to repair or replace bridges across the country. But the repairs are targeted at only about a third of an estimated 43,000 bridges deemed to be in poor condition. And states have struggled to pay for multi-million dollar safety improvements, constantly balancing the cost against what may be seen as an isolated risk of disaster. Department of Transportation officials in Washington State have said they will be watching the Baltimore investigation to determine whether new pier protections on the Lewis and Clark Bridge might be needed, but caution that the state has limited funds. This would be an improvement project that would cost tens of millions of dollars, said Kelly Hanahan, a department spokeswoman. Some states have focused less on upgrading their bridges and instead are working on plans to evacuate them quickly in the event of a ship strike or other problem. Some are concentrating on improving navigation and tugboat protocols to lessen the likelihood of collisions. Others are rolling the dice. Vulnerable bridges are standing in some of the busiest shipping waterways. One example, the Crescent City Connection in New Orleans. The bridge has two spans, one built in 1958 and another in 1988. Both were completed before the adoption of more modern standards to mitigate the risk of a large vessel collision. A pair of private engineering researchers started looking at the bridge and two others nearby in the 1990s after a series of vessel accidents, including some involving ships that lost power, as was most likely the case with the ship in Baltimore. In findings published for their peers, they found that the protection system around the bridges, quote, do not have the strength and energy absorption capacity to affect the consequences of major vessel collisions, unquote, and that the bridge's foundations might not survive a head-on collision. The Times analysis found bridges with similar documented flaws at a variety of other big ports. In Florida, where the Dolphin Expressway carries more than 50,000 vehicles per day across the Miami River, the bridge supports are protected by what inspectors have described as a deteriorating system. The transportation agency managing the bridge said it is working to replace the protection system. And we'll stop that article there. We're going to go on to the current. I have the story about the geese in Bristol. Local and national animal rights groups are working to block a proposed geese management plan in Bristol that would authorize the roundup and killing of geese at Veterans Memorial Park and other city-owned properties. Bristol officials said more aggressive tactics are necessary to address a hazardous geese population they say is growing out of control, littering walkways and grassy areas with excrement. Animal advocates criticize the lethal methods outlined in the proposal, describing these strategies as inhumane and ineffective when cleanup options are available. The Bristol Board of Park Commissioners will vote Wednesday on whether or not to forward the geese management plan to the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection for final approval. Bristol's Department of Parks, Recreation, Youth, and Community Services said the city has expended more than $15,000 on non-lethal management efforts since 2017. While the department said these methods, quote, yielded temporary results, unquote, ultimately the geese population has not decreased. The proposal would authorize the department to enter into a one-year, $3,365 agreement with USDA Wildlife Services to manage the geese populations at Veterans Memorial Boulevard Park, Pine Lake Park, Malone's Pond, and other city-owned properties through lethal and non-lethal methods. We're not trying to eliminate all the geese. We're just trying to control the population, said Mayor Jeffrey Caggiano, the chair of the board. This is not a population that is in danger. This is not a population that is on the decline. Caggiano said the city began exploring new mitigation strategies months ago when members of the Bristol Veterans Council asked local officials to step it up and do something different about the geese poop at the park, which honors the lives and sacrifice of servicemen and women. Priscilla Farrell, the president of Friends of Animals, said that if droppings are the problem, the conversation should be about cleanup, not killing. Farrell explained that goose roundups occur when flocks experience a flightless molting period between mid-June and mid-August after their eggs hatch. According to DEEP, The process involves herding geese into portable nets and then euthanizing the birds off-site. They're going to physically assault parents, their goslings, and then gas them with nitrous oxide and call it a goose management plan, Farrell said. I think it's obscene, and I hope the DEEP will agree. Farrell said the proposal would put Bristol on the path of a killing treadmill as new flocks settle in the location where deceased birds once nested. Nature abhors a vacuum, Farrell said. It's going to be repeated year after year because when you remove one flock of geese, it invites other geese to occupy that area. Farrell said that in order to stop geese from coming to the pond, Bristol must make the environment less accommodating. Farrell explained that geese prefer golf course-type habitats with wide open areas that allow flocks to easily spot predators. Until the city modifies the landscape, Farrell said, Bristol should clean up after the birds. I think the best thing they can do is invest in the lawn-sweeping equipment, Farrell said. They're treating native wildlife as though it's snow removal, Farrell said. Friends of Animals finds it deeply offensive, and we really think there is a remedy, and that's to clean up after geese in the park. And we're going to go to the front page again, the story about the hush money trial in New York of Donald Trump. The first seven jurors for Donald Trump's hush money trial were chosen Tuesday after lawyers grilled members of the jury pool about their social media posts, political views, and personal lives to decide whether they can sit in fair judgment of the former president. The panelists, who were sworn in, are an IT worker, an English teacher, an oncology nurse, a sales professional, a software engineer, and two lawyers. 11 more people still must be picked before opening statements begin as early as next week in the Manhattan case accusing the Republican falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal during his 2016 campaign. The trial, which began Monday, puts Trump's legal problems at the center of his closely contested race against President Joe Biden. It's the first of Trump's four criminal cases to go to trial, and it may be the only one to reach a verdict before voters decide in November whether to elect the presumptive GOP presidential nominee. On the second day of jury selection, New Yorkers were quizzed for hours about their views on Trump and other issues. Eight were excused after saying they could not be impartial or because they had other commitments. Trump's lawyers challenged a handful of people over social media posts, and one person was dismissed over a 2017 post about Trump that said, "Lock him up." Several would-be jurors told the judge they believe they could decide the case fairly, no matter their feelings about Trump or his policies as president. Trump looked on in the courtroom as his lawyers urged the judge to remove one potential juror for a social media post she made after his 2020 election loss. The judge admonished Trump at one point after he spoke loudly and gestured while the judge questioned the woman about her post. "I don't know what he was uttering, but it was audible, and he was gesturing, and he was speaking in the direction of the juror," Judge Juan Merchant said. "I won't tolerate that. I will not tolerate any jurors being intimidated in this courtroom." Prosecutor Joshua Steinglass took Trump's notoriety head on, telling would-be jurors that attorneys were not looking for people who had been living under a rock for this past 8 years. They just need to keep an open mind. "This case has nothing to do with your personal politics. It's not a referendum on the Trump presidency or a popularity contest or who you're going to vote for in November. We don't care. This case is about whether the man broke the law," he said. And we're going to stop now for the weather. We're going to have the national forecast from the New York Times, and then I will have the local forecast. Here's the national forecast. A large storm reaching the Great Lakes today will spread showers and thunderstorms across a large part of the east. Severe thunderstorms will develop from Tennessee to southern Michigan and as far east as western Pennsylvania. Possible hazards will include flash flooding, hail, damaging wind gusts, and isolated tornadoes. Snow and colder air will move into the northern Rockies, while warm and dry conditions will continue across much of the south. A breeze will bring humid air into the south-central region. Gusty winds from the northwest will usher colder air into the northern plains, and temperatures will trend 5 to 10 degrees lower than average. And we're going to take a short break and be back with the local weather.
Guidepost Magazine is on Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday mornings at 7:30 on Chris.
The forecast for tonight has showers, with a low around 44. Tomorrow, Thursday, showers are likely. It'll be cloudy, with a high near 51. And tomorrow night, there's a slight chance of showers. It'll be cloudy, with a low around 41. Friday will be cloudy, with a high near 58. And Friday night, there's a chance of showers. Mostly cloudy, with a low around 44. Saturday will be partly sunny, with a high near 65. And Saturday night, mostly clear, with a low around 39. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Back to the front page of The Current for this story. The number of babies who accidentally die from suffocation because they sleep with their parents or other caregivers remains stubbornly high in Connecticut. A big reason is parents, many of them single caregivers, who need to calm a baby to get a decent night's sleep because they need to get to work in the morning. 4 of 5 children who died of sudden, unexpected infant death in a 32-month period were enrolled in Medicaid, according to a July 2023 report by the State Office of the Child Advocate and Dr. Kirsten Bechtel, a Yale School of Medicine pediatrician. But one agency head advocating for reducing infant mortality believes racism underlies at least some of the problem, including in the role it plays in economics, trust in doctors, sharing information, access to health care, and lack of prenatal care. We've persistently averaged over 20 infant deaths a year to unsafe sleeping habits, said Brendan Burke, assistant child advocate, and that's significant. A significant part of child mortality in the first few months of life. A majority are under 3 months old. There is one other rising threat, fentanyl. 12 children have died from exposure to the drug since 2020, Burke said. One in 2024. 30 have been saved because Narcan was administered in time, he said. But most deaths are because we're seeing young kids put to sleep in environments that aren't safe, most commonly an adult-sized bed, and oftentimes co-sleeping with a parent, Burke said. He said there are a number of factors that contribute, one of which is a parent's ability to manage a crying child in the middle of the night with the pressures of getting up for work in the morning to ensure that they have the resources to provide for that child and their family. In a majority of cases, Burke said, we've seen environments where safe sleep environments are available for the children. The kids aren't ending up there. They're ending up in an adult-sized bed, which is the biggest risk factor going. Among the efforts to reverse the problem is a pilot home visiting program in Bridgeport, where supports are coming to the family in the most supportive way possible, Burke said. Coming to the home is relieving a lot of stress from a parent that may be deterred from going to an appointment outside the home, he said. These people are coming into the home, viewing the environment, meeting individuals where they're at, and able to target and tailor services as needed. Bechtel said lack of trust in medical personnel is a problem. A lot of it because they feel like sudden, unexpected infant death is not going to happen to them, that they don't trust the pediatrician, that they trust other people, people within their social network, more about advice, she said. And so trying to compete with these alternative sources of information is something that we're trying to work on, especially at Yale. We've been working really hard to understand why parents choose to bed share and trying to understand why they do something would give us some idea of how to prevent it. Bechtel said Yale staff have been working with people that have more of their finger on the pulse of what's going on in the community to better help understand why parents choose to have their babies sleep with them. And we have one more story. It's on the front page of The Current. With her job on the line Tuesday, Chief Public Defender Tashawn Bowden-Lewis dodged questions about her conduct, and members of the commission that oversees her office seemed at times incredulous at her responses. At one point, Commission Chairman Richard Palmer who was questioning Bolden Lewis about her admission that she secretly accessed his email conversations with the Vision employees, asked whether she believed it was, quote, appropriate, unquote, for her to superiorly read his legal privileged correspondence with the division's legal counsel. Email on a computer at the Division of Public Defender Services is a free game, Bolden Lewis replied. Bolden Lewis' decision to access email accounts of her critics was just one of the topics that came up as an unusual hearing began at the Capitol Complex in Hartford that seemed, at least on Tuesday, possibly to cost the embattled chief public defender her job. After her new lawyer, former Bridgeport Mayor Thomas Bucci, argued for nearly an hour that what amounts to a termination hearing was a violation of Bolden Lewis's constitutional due process rights, members of the Public Defender Service Commission questioned her about a detailed list of 16 charges that runs from email hacking to making unfounded allegations of racism to lying to and impeding the work of the Oversight Commission. Frequently, Bolden Lewis gave short responses to questions or said she could not recall events and answers that appeared to frustrate the commission members. A forensic examination of the hacked email accounts revealed, according to the commission, that Bolden Lewis was provided with printed copies of Palmer's email correspondence, but often when pressed, said that she could not recall whether she read the material. She was asked specifically about written warnings to the commission from one of her personal attorneys, implying that the commission discriminated against her as a black woman by questioning her management decisions. Members also wanted her to give her view of an outside investigation by the Hartford law firm Shipman and Goodwin that concluded she has shown a propensity to resort to baseless allegations of racism merely because someone disagrees with her. Bolden Lewis' response suggested that she views the termination hearing as evidence of ongoing discrimination. She referred to a U.S. Supreme Court decision that she says held that it is discrimination to retaliate against someone who makes allegations of racial discrimination. And we're going to go to a news briefing here from Washington Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell on Tuesday cautioned that persistently elevated inflation will likely delay any Fed interest rate cuts until later this year, opening the door to a period of higher for longer rates. Recent data have clearly not given us greater confidence that inflation is coming fully under control and instead indicate that it's likely to take longer than expected to achieve that confidence, Powell said during a panel discussion at the Wilson Center. If higher inflation does persist, we can maintain the current level of internet rates for us as long as we need to. The Fed chair's comments suggested that without further evidence that inflation is falling, the central bank may carry out fewer than the 0.75-point reductions its officials had forecast during their most recent meeting in March. His remarks Tuesday represented a shift for Powell, who on March 7th had told a Senate committee that the Fed was not far from gaining the confidence if needed to cut rates. At a news conference March 20th, Powell appeared to downplay that assertion, but his comments Tuesday went further in dimming the likelihood of any rate cuts in the coming months. In the past several weeks, government data has shown that inflation remains stubbornly above the Fed's 2% target and that the economy is still growing robustly. Year-over-year inflation rose to 3.5% in March from 3.2% in February, and a closely watched gauge of core prices, which exclude volatile food and energy, rose sharply for a third consecutive month. As recently as December, Wall Street traders had priced in as many as 0.75-point rate cuts this year. Now they foresee only 2 rate cuts, with the first coming in September. Powell's comments followed a speech earlier Tuesday by Fed Vice Chair Philip Jefferson, who also appeared to raise the prospect that the Fed would not carry out three cuts this year in its benchmark rate. The Fed's rate stands at a 23-year high of 5.3% after 11 rate hikes beginning 2 years ago. And I have another news briefing. President Joe Biden's latest plans that he has for student loan cancellation, is moving forward at a proposed regulation, offering him a fresh chance to deliver on a campaign promise and energize young voters ahead of the November election. The Education Department on Tuesday filed paperwork for a new regulation that would deliver the cancellation that Biden announced last week. It still has to go through a 30-day public comment period and another review before it can be finalized. It's a more targeted proposal than the one the U.S. Supreme Court struck down last year. The new plan uses a different legal basis and seeks to cancel or reduce loans for more than 25 million Americans. Conservative opponents, who see it as an unfair burden for taxpayers who didn't attend college, have threatened to challenge it in court. And we're going to move over now to the world and nation section of The Current. I have this story. Ukraine's top military commander has issued a bleak assessment of the Army's positions on the Eastern Front, saying they have worsened significantly in recent days. Russian forces were pushing hard to exploit their growing advantage in manpower and ammunition to break through Ukrainian lines, the Commander General Alexander Syrsky said in a statement over the weekend. Despite significant losses, the enemy is increasing its efforts by using new units on armored vehicles, thanks to which he periodically achieves tactical gains, the general said. At the same time, Ukraine's energy ministry told millions of civilians to charge their power banks, get their generators out of storage, and be ready for any scenario, as Ukrainian power plants are damaged or destroyed in devastating Russian airstrikes. With few critical military supplies flowing into Ukraine from the U.S., commanders are being forced to make difficult choices over where to deploy limited resources as the toll on civilians grows daily. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a controversial law Tuesday, days after it was passed by Parliament, potentially helping Kyiv to boost conscription to replenish depleted forces to fend off Russia's continued aggression, the Associated Press reported. The mobilization law is expected to take effect in a month and make it easier to identify every draft-eligible man in the country. Many have dodged conscription by avoiding contact with authorities. The law also provides soldiers with incentives such as cash bonuses or money toward buying a house or car, which Ukraine can't afford, according to analyses. And the rest of our stories from The Current today will come from the World and Nation section until we get to the Connecticut section about three quarters past the hour. Washington, the Supreme Court on Tuesday questioned whether federal prosecutors went too far in bringing obstruction charges against hundreds of participants in the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. But it wasn't clear how the justices would rule in a case that also could affect the prosecution of former President Donald Trump, who faces the same charge for his efforts to overturn his election loss in 2020. The justices heard arguments over the charge of obstruction of an official proceeding in the case of Joseph Fisher, a former Pennsylvania police officer who has been indicted for his role in disrupting Congress's certification of Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election victory over Trump. Fisher is one of 330 people facing that charge, which stems from a law passed in the aftermath of the Enron financial scandal more than two decades ago to deal with the destruction of documents. Trump is facing two charges in a separate case brought by Special Counsel Jack Smith in Washington that could be knocked out with a favorable ruling from the nation's highest court. Next week, the justices will hear arguments over whether the former president and presumptive nominee for the 2024 Republican nomination has absolute immunity from prosecution in that case, a proposition that has been rejected by two lower courts. Smith has argued separately in the immunity case that the obstruction charges against Trump are valid no matter how the court decides Fisher's case. The first former U.S. president under indictment, Trump is on trial on hush money charges in New York and also has been charged with election interference in Georgia and with mishandling classified documents in Florida. It was not clear after more than 90 minutes of arguments precisely where the court would land in the Fisher's case. Conservative Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch appeared most likely to side with Fisher, while liberal Justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor seemed more favorable to the Justice Department's position. Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson, a former federal public defender, expressed interest in more of a middle ground outcome that might make it harder but not impossible for prosecutors to use the obstruction charge. Some of the conservative justices said the law was so broad that it could be used against even peaceful protests, and also questioned why the Justice Department has not brought charges under the provision in other violent protests. There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings, Justice Clarence Thomas said. He was back on the bench Tuesday after an unexplained one-day absence. Gorsuch appeared to be drawing on actual events when he asked Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar whether people could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding if they rose in protest inside the courtroom, heckled the president at the State of the Union, or pulled a fire alarm in the Capitol complex to delay a vote in progress. Alito, suggesting the government's reading of the law is too broad, asked whether the charge could be applied to people who disrupted the day's court session by shouting, "Keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail," or "Free the January 6th patriots." He hastened to add, "What happened on January 6th was very, very serious, and I'm not equating this with that." From Washington, defiant and determined, House Speaker Mike Johnson pushed back Tuesday against mounting Republican anger over his proposed U.S. aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, and rejected a call to step aside or risk a vote to oust him from office. "I am not resigning," Johnson said after a testy morning meeting of fellow Republicans at the Capitol. Johnson referred to himself as a, quote, "wartime speaker," unquote, of the House, and indicated in his strongest self-defense yet that he would press forward with a U.S. national security aid package, a situation that would force him to rely on Democrats to help pass it over objections from his weakened majority. "We are simply here trying to do our jobs," Johnson said, calling the motion to oust him absurd, not helpful. Tuesday brought a definite shift in tone from House Republicans and the Speaker at a pivotal moment as the embattled leader tries against the wishes of his majority to marshal the votes needed to send the stalled national security aid for overseas allies to passage. Johnson appeared emboldened by his meeting late last week with Donald Trump, when the former president threw him a political lifetime with a nod of support after their private talk at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. At his own press conference Tuesday, Johnson spoke of the importance of ensuring that Trump, who is now at his criminal trial in New York, is reelected to the White House. Johnson also spoke over the weekend with President Joe Biden and other congressional leaders about the emergency U.S. Aid package, which the Speaker plans to move in separate votes for each section, with bills for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific region. He spoke about it with Biden again late Monday. "It's a complicated approach that breaks apart the Senate's $95 billion aid package for several votes and then stitches it back together for the president's signature. The approach will require the speaker to cobble together bipartisan majorities with different factions of House Republicans and Democrats on each measure. Additionally, Johnson is preparing a fourth measure that would include various Republican-preferred national security priorities, such as a plan to seize some Russian assets in U.S. banks to help fund Ukraine, and another to turn the economic aid for Ukraine into loans. The plan is not an automatic deal-breaker for Democrats in the House and Senate, with leaders refraining from comment until they see the actual text of the measure, which was due out later Tuesday. From Scranton, Pennsylvania, President Joe Biden returned to his working-class childhood hometown of Scranton on Tuesday. The call for higher taxes on the rich and cast former President Donald Trump as an out-of-touch elitist, part of an attempt to blunt the populist appeal of his predecessor's comeback bid. Biden's stop opened three consecutive days of campaigning in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, while his opponent spends much of the week in a New York courtroom for his first criminal trial. Biden used Scranton, a city of roughly 75,000 people, as the backdrop to argue that getting rich in America is fine, but it should come with heftier tax bills. He dismissed Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee and a billionaire, as a tool of wealthy interests. It's all aimed at reframing the conversation about the economy, which has left many Americans feeling sour about their financial situation at a time of stubborn inflation and elevated interest rates despite low employment. When I look at the economy, I don't look at it through the eyes of Mar-a-Lago. I look at it through the eyes of Scranton, the president said, contrasting his modest upbringing with the Florida state where the former president lives. Biden has proposed a 25% minimum tax rate for billionaires, which he said would swell federal coffers by hundreds of billions of dollars. He added that such levies are how we invest in the country. Scranton values, or Mar-a-Lago values, Biden said. These are the competing visions for our economy that raises questions of fundamental fairness at the heart of his campaign. He spoke at a community center from a stage flanked by a banner reading Tax Fairness for All Americans. The president said decades of GOP policies that cut taxes for the wealthy with the idea of stimulating the economy failed America, and Donald Trump embodies that failure. He detailed his own working-class upbringing while scoffing that Trump's background taught him little more than, quote, the best way to get rich is to inherit it, unquote. Along the way, Biden worked in jokes about the sharp fall in market value of the former president's social media platform. Biden took part in a training session for grassroots organizers at a union hall before swinging by his old house. Biden grew up in a colonial home in the Green Ridge neighborhood until his father struggled to find work and moved the family to Delaware when the future president was 10. Joe Biden was never forgotten where he's from, has never forgotten where he's from. Scranton Mayor Paige Cognetti said before Biden's speech, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro echoed the idea, saying this is a guy who has never forgotten the people he grew up with. Biden was spending the night in Scranton before continuing to Pittsburgh on Wednesday and visiting Philadelphia on Thursday. From Washington, the House sent two articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate on Tuesday, forcing a trial on allegations that he has willfully and systematically refused to enforce immigration laws. While the Senate is obligated to hold a trial under the rules of impeachment once the charges are walked across the Capitol, the proceedings may not last long. Democrats are expected to try to dismiss or table the changes later this week before the full arguments get underway. After walking the articles to the Senate, the Republican prosecutors appointed by House Speaker Mike Johnson stood in the well of the Senate. The Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, the chamber's top security official, called the session to order with a hear ye, in a notice that all persons are commanded to keep silence on pain of imprisonment. The House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Mark Green, a Tennessee Republican, who is one of the impeachment managers, read the articles aloud as most senators sat in their seats, following along with their own paper copies. Republicans have argued that there should be a full trial, as Johnson signed the articles Monday in preparation for sending them across the Capitol. He said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer should convene a trial to hold those who engineered this crisis to full account. Schumer is the only impediment to delivering accountability for the American people, Johnson said. Pursuant to the Constitution, the House demands a trial. After Tuesday's ceremonial presentation of the articles, proceedings will not begin until Wednesday. Senators will be sworn in as jurors, turning the chamber into the court of impeachment. The Senate will issue a summons to Mayorkas to inform him of the charges and ask for a written answer. He won't have to appear. The entire process could be done within hours Wednesday. Majority Democrats have said the GOP case against Mayorkas doesn't rise to the high crimes and misdemeanors laid out as a bar for impeachment in the Constitution, and Schumer probably has enough votes to end the trial immediately if he decides to do so. Schumer has said he wants to address this issue as expeditiously as possible. Impeachment should never be used to settle a policy disagreement, Schumer said. That would be a horrible precedent for the Congress. And we're going to move over now to the Connecticut section of the Current for the rest of our stories. A landlord is seeking to evict the Place to Be restaurant from Hartford's Constitution Plaza for not paying tens of thousands of dollars in rent. It says it did everything possible to resolve the matter before turning to the courts. We have made multiple attempts to resolve the outstanding payment issues with both the Place to Be owner and its legal counsel before filing the eviction notice with the courts, said Chris Riley, president of Lexington Partners, in a statement. Restaurateur Gina Lawari, who is moving ahead with plans for expanding her flagship The Place to Be franchise, reiterated Tuesday she has withheld rent payments because Lexington, a part owner of 5 Constitution Plaza and its property manager, has failed to address ongoing flooding problems in her lease space. According to Lexington, Lawari now owns $79,768 in unpaid rent. The restaurant is located in a storefront of the Spectra Plaza apartment. In the statement, Riley said Lexington has responded to all Lawari's concerns about flood damage. Last year's flood, a result of an overwhelmed MDC system, impacted residents and businesses throughout Hartford, including the Place to Be, Riley said. We fully resolved that damage to her business, and the Place to Be was fully operational in 3 days. Two police officers were injured after a large gathering at a beach in West Haven was followed by a shooting at a nearby gas station on Monday, leading to a total of 12 arrests. Officers responded to the report of multiple fights at a beach in West Haven, where large crowds gathered around 3 p.m. for a party that was promoted on social media. Joseph Perno, chief of police of the West Haven Police Department, said at a news conference on Tuesday. An officer who responded to the beach was assaulted and suffered minor injuries, Perno said, adding that about 2,000 people, mostly comprised of teens and young adults, had gathered there. I was very, very upset that when people who were coming here to enjoy the beach left because of this, Perno told reporters Monday night. It was a very upsetting situation to see that. Parents, people were walking their dogs, and then they had to leave because of this nonsense. West Haven police dispersed the large crowd from the beach area with the assistance of Connecticut State Police and officers from the Milford and Orange Police Departments. As this was happening, officers around 7 p.m. received a report of a nearby shooting in the area of Campbell Avenue and Noble Street near the Best Gas Convenient Mart and gas station, and the report of an altercation involving a crowd about a block north. Perno said a passerby driving in the area was struck in the face with either bullet or glass fragments when his windshield was hit with gunfire, his injuries were not life-threatening. According to Perno, another car was also hit by gunfire in the trunk area. That vehicle was occupied by a mother and her children. No one in that vehicle was injured. Perno said an officer was injured while trying to apprehend the suspects believed to be tied to the shooting who were in a vehicle. The officer suffered minor injuries. Police were able to make a felony car stop involving a vehicle with seven individuals and a gun inside. According to Perno, the individuals were charged and the gun was seized. The suspects have not been identified. After hours of debate about what West Hartford should be in the future, town officials, in a bipartisan vote, cleared the way for 322 new apartments in five-story buildings on part of the former University of Connecticut campus in West Hartford. Creating new housing on the blighted 1700 Asylum Avenue property will be a massive boost for West Hartford overall and ultimately will benefit the surrounding neighborhood, town councilors, and after a six-hour hearing, they said. But a crowd of neighbors disagreed. During the hearing, they declared passionately that modernistic mid-rise apartment towers would never blend into their neighborhood of traditional one-family houses. They warned of falling property values and worsening traffic. Some suggested the town acquire the land as open space. Others said a subdivision of single-family homes would work. But the council concluded that there were far more reasons to endorse the project than to block it, and voted 8-1 to approve a zone charge that developer Dominic Carpiano, West Harvest LLC, needed to proceed with its Heritage Park vision. The project would be the biggest development in West Hartford since Blueback Square, and the 1700 Asylum parcel is only the first half of what's planned. West Hartford, later this year, is expected to apply for a wetlands permit to begin advancing the second half of Heritage Park, the 1800 Asylum Avenue parcel that's on the western side of the old UConn campus. The company last year was looking to put up nearly 250 housing units with a mix of townhouses, apartments, and assisted living units, along with a large restaurant, grocery store, and other retail. After hitting complications about wetlands, Carpinato withdrew his initial application to allow time for more engineering work. In the meantime, he focused on 1700 Asylum Avenue, the eastern half of campus that tracks southern section fronts on Asylum. It will remain as community playing fields, according to West Hartford One. Development would be on the northern section where the sprawling remains of UConn's parking lot with cracked pavement and weeds has stood deteriorating for 7 years. The plan is to tear up the ruined blacktop, do an environmental cleanup, and build apartments and new parking. Heritage Park will occupy a smaller footprint than the old parking lot, so some of the space will be returned to landscaping and lawn. On Monday night, Carpinato's attorney announced K&K Development will buy the northern section of the 1700 Asylum property, then build the apartment complex and manage it. Robin Pearson, Carpinato's attorney, noted that K&K is an affiliate of Garden Homes and is currently building 260 apartments at the entryway to the Trumbull Mall. Garden Homes is a privately held development company established in 1954. It has built and owns more than 55,000 apartment units and develops about 2,500 additional units a year, Pearson told the crowd. And I have one more story to read. A Connecticut baking company focuses on Nordic-style baked goods, and that includes everything from breads to sweet treats. At Spruce and Rye Baking Company, an artisanal micro-bakery in West Hartford, They use traditional methods and techniques with organic ingredients and no preservatives, the owner said. The means baking unique, handmade Nordic-inspired breads, buns, sweets, and pastries in a modern yet minimalistic way, featuring a palette of bold colors. Artisanal bakeries offer a more curated and handcrafted approach. We use higher quality and better ingredients and give more focus and attention to detail when compared to bakeries with mass production, said owner Joe Palladaro, one of the mayor